You and I back together again, kicking off a brand new week, Monday, May 15th, 2023, on Connecticut Today. We had news of a possible move to get rid of the state's motor vehicle property tax. Sacred Heart University political science professor Dr. Gary Rose checked in with his monthly update. We had remarks from Connecticut Democratic Senator Chris Murphy on NBC's Meet the Press regarding the current immigration situation at the southern border. And finally, CTNewsJunkie.com columnist Terry Cowgill talked about his recent encounter with a bear inside his home.
So how do you make up the money, you know, in Hartford or in your city or town when you eliminate revenue or tax money from, you know, somebody, something, some person, some business, some entity, whatever? Everybody says, well, geez, we're not getting the money that we were getting from that person, that place, that thing. You know, the spigots now been turned off. So how do we fix that? Hi, how are you? We're back and starting with that question today on this Monday, halfway through May 2023. Interesting story here. And I had no idea this was going on. As much as I read, I didn't see this mentioned the other day. Now, you know, I talk about among the things I cry and bitch and moan about on this show all the time. One of the ones that just drives me crazy is the property tax on your motor vehicle. It drives me nuts. And your motor vehicle is taxed on the same mill rate that, say, a home is, or a condo is, or a an apartment building is in a town or city, which is ludicrous. It's one of the most asinine ways of generating revenue on God's green earth. And it's perfectly illustrated in the fact that all you need to do is talk to somebody you know, a coworker, a friend, a family member who may have right around the same model, make, or year of vehicle that you have. Within a year or two, whatever, but, you know, it has pretty much the same assessed book value. And if they're living in some affluent town, they're paying, I don't know, $20, $25 maybe on the mill rate there, 25 mills, right? 25 bucks on every assessed $1,000 of assessed value. And then you might be in a couple of towns over, maybe not as, you know, not as affluent, not as hoity-toity as everyone else, but you're paying 38, 40, 42, 43 mills, and it's ridiculous. And, you know, if it's your home, like I said, if it's a physical domicile, if it's an apartment building that you rent a unit from somebody, if that's what we're talking about, if it's a house, if it's a condo, if it's a duplex, something that you own, you can say, well, okay, the location means something, right? Location, location, location. All right, yeah. Yeah, heck, you know, the value of a home or a condo or whatever, or maybe a small or medium-sized apartment building that you could recoup on rents, by and large, right, is said at least in part in where it is. You take the exact same home that you live in, a freestanding house or a condo or whatever, a townhome, and you take that from town A and magically airdrop it, gently please, into town B, guess what? The value is going to change. It's ridiculous. So I cannot stand. It makes me want to take a bite out of the wall every 6 months or every year when I pay my car taxes in my town. Nothing against the fine people that are tasked with collecting that, but it's ridiculous. And we're only one of, I think, less than 15 or two dozen states or whatever that still does this. Well, why do I start with this today? Because how about this? That might be going away. Did you hear me? Test, 1, 2, 3. The taxes, the personal property tax, which you and I pay on our motor vehicles, may be going away. Dear God, thank you. Maybe. But here's the problem. How do you replace that money? Because you and I both know that as we're standing in line to pay our car taxes at City or Town Hall, we've had that same thought, right? Where we say, well, geez, I don't like paying this tax, but my town or city relies on it. So again, it's nice to get rid of this, but where is the rest of that revenue going to come from? Whether it's in some lower Fairfield County cities and towns, or, you know, cities like Hartford, New Haven, Bridgeport, the blue-leaning cities that, you know, do rely a lot on that motor vehicle property tax. Well, how about this? I did not know this happened, because I can't know anything. Today's story in the Connecticut Post, our buddy Ken Dixon, who's been on the show, could Connecticut end local vehicle taxes? Oh, yes. After a big debate, the Senate last week approved a bill. Now, calm down, tap the brakes, slow down. Slow down, you're going down the hill, tap the brakes, take it out of gear. A bill that would be a first step toward eliminating the levy while still giving towns the money they need. So here's what's going to happen now. And I want to get your input on this as to where do you think we can find this money? Because your city or town's going to need the money. You can't just say, well, car tax has gone, yippee. You will end up paying on it. You will. You're going to have to. And maybe in a roundabout way, there's another way they're going to make you do this. Maybe not with your car's value per se, but something that has a value with that. We'll tell you about that momentarily. But the bill is going down to the House, and if it's approved by the House, it was approved already in the Senate, it would create a task force. Yes, I've never served on one of those. I have an itching, burning desire. In fact, it's itching and burning so much, I had to use a soothing salve on it, or a balm, or a comforting cream, or some lotion. The bill would create a task force with a deadline of not too far down the road, February of next year. So less than a year away. So 9 months. So how about this? We may get a task force, yes, that would have to report back in 9 months to say, hey, okay, all you chooches, you want to get rid of the motor vehicle tax like the guy in the afternoon does on WICC. How do you pay for it? Now, they have a deadline here. Again, as I said, February of 2024, they would make recommendations on ways to repeal the motor vehicle property tax. How do you do that? You tell me. Now, I'll give you a way that seems to be high on the list here. Now, it is in some way, shape, or form connected to your car in almost the same way as your locale is. We'll tell you about that coming up. But what would you do if you were on, because you have to come up with an answer. You have to. So let's play a little game here on a Monday, the 15th of May, 2023, coming up on 16 past the hour. Why don't we play a little game here? I want you to think for me, come up with an idea or two, and let me know, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. I'm sure that the vast majority of you out there believe, not believe me necessarily, but agree with me, maybe, that there's got to be a better way to find revenue than paying tax over and over and over and over and over again, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 years on a car that you bought a decade earlier in some instances. But the thing is, you have to come up with the money. Because let's face it, if you take all the car tax revenue out of Bridgeport, if you take all the car tax revenue out of New Haven, if you take all the car tax revenue out of Hartford or any city or town in this great state of ours, you're going to have a gaping hole in the budget. So you tell me, all right, Paul, I think this is how we can make up some of that money, because you are going to have to. How do we do it?
203-333-9422, 333-WICC. So I nominate you to become an immediate member of our own task force. And you don't have to wait until February of next year. You can tell me right now, okay, Paul, we get rid of the property taxes, that every year tax or that every 6 month tax, however your city or town does it, on your car, on your truck, on your SUV, on your neat little two-seater, on your motorcycle. We're going to get rid of that, and here's how we're going to make up the revenue. And time for our monthly check-in with this gentleman. Always has some interesting thoughts about all things politics, local and national. Sacred Heart University political science professor Dr. Gary Rose is with us. Gary, it's Paul here. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing well, Paul. Good to hear from you.
And Gary, I guess you folks at Fairfield there and the staff and faculty have unleashed another 2,000 young minds into the vast stretch of the fruited plain, right?
Yeah, it was huge graduation yesterday at the amphitheater, the Hartford Amphitheater in Bridgeport. Both the graduate program as well as the undergraduate program. And it was beautiful, wonderful students, and a lot of, tremendous energy and a lot of high aspirations, which is really wonderful to see. And I was involved in both ceremonies, and I read the citation, actually, for the honorary degree recipient for the graduate program, and that was the very distinguished Chief Justice Richard Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of Connecticut, and I was really honored to do that. It was a great experience.
That's great. And, Gary, I don't care how dour people sound like me, and I get paid for it. I understand that. But you know, I guess graduations, and my son graduated a few years ago from his college. You know, you do look around, and no matter what you think or where you fall on the spectrum, you know, there's another new crop of young folks who, the vast majority of which, Gary, will do their best to make our world a little better.
I think you're right. I'm very optimistic with this, not just this class, but with the generation, generally speaking. They've been through some tough times with the pandemic, and of course that had a devastating effect for some of the students. But they seem to have recovered. There was a lot of joy and a lot of spirit, and I think that this generation is going to do really some good things for our country.
Gary, a lot of interesting things going on in Hartford, and it's interesting the dynamic of Ned Lamont, and you and I have talked about this before, and the guys and gals in his own party. Now, socially, he is clearly a left-leaning liberal, and that's fine. That's what you're going to get here. But, you know, it's interesting, Gary. I read a piece probably about 5 or 6 months ago, and it might have been in the National Review or the Spectator, something along that line. And the tone of the piece was, hey, don't look now, but Connecticut's governor is about as close to as a Republican as you're going to get when it comes to monetary issues. And I think he's continuing, Gary, to try and keep the state on somewhat of a logical path here.
100% right. You know, the governor was on campus a little while ago, mm-hmm. a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And I had an opportunity to have some private discussions with
him. Oh, nice.
Yeah. We were just out on the sidewalk, but nevertheless, it was just he and I speaking. And he did say that with the budget going on and his tax reforms, that the Republicans are his greatest ally in the state legislature.
Wait a minute. Did anybody else hear that? Because you're the only one.
I know. Yeah. And without a doubt. And you really, you hear, Candeloria and so forth are very much supporting his cuts. What is interesting about that, though, is, he did speak in his State of the Union address, and I reminded him of that he wanted to push for tax cuts.
Mm-hmm.
But then in the campaign against Stefanowski, he really didn't speak too much about that, I guess, perhaps because he didn't want to alienate, the progressive wing of his party. But now that the election is over and he did win by a landslide, he's going to now really, I think, push this new economic agenda. And it makes so much sense, too, because we have, a big surplus, and I think it is time to really start talking about some tax reform. So Yeah, but you're right, though, Paul, that it's the he's starting to sound more and more like a Republican. In fact, if you didn't have the name Lamont, you might think it's Stefanowski who won the race.
Well, at least on the dollars and cents side of it, yeah. Our monthly check-in with Fairfield, check that Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Sacred Heart political science professor, the renowned Dr. Gary Rose, with us for a few more moments. Gary segueing from Hartford to D.C. and maybe bouncing down to the border. Boy, Gary, this border issue here, now that Title 42 has been rescinded and you've got the Republicans saying one thing, you've got the Democrats saying something else. Gary, I wonder, though, if this is just resounding with people, maybe even not necessarily Democrats or Republicans, but those people in the middle, Gary, who are saying to themselves, why can't we fix this thing? Because I think, Gary, you see that video and you see people just being allowed to, mostly anyway, unless they're turned away, come across. And I got to tell you, I don't know how people, Gary, at least in my mind, won't take that into account come the 2024 race.
Oh, sure. And then you have, you know, Secretary Mayorkas constantly saying that the border is secure. And then, as you note, Paul, you know, you have the video showing people streaming across the river and then something actually, you know, then moving into the United States as well. And so I don't know. I mean, you have this dichotomy going on of the Biden administration telling everybody things are under control. And when, in fact, the video evidence does not in any way whatsoever support that. And I don't believe it's doctored, you know, video either.
Yeah.
And so it is going to be, once again, an issue, as it was in 2016. It was not so much of an issue in 2020. But in 2024, as you're 100% correct, I think that the border, once again, is going to be probably among the top three issues in the campaign.
And, Gary, something I know that you've probably, I'm sure, have seen and have thought about, you know, and again, I don't profess to engage in ageism here. I'm equally as critical of people on the left and the right that stay around for too long. But this situation with Dianne Feinstein and the photo of her the other day in a wheelchair being wheeled back to Congress. I mean, Gary, after a while, I mean, 90 years old, and there are people on the left now, as well as the right, saying, what's going on here? It makes one angry, sad. There's a tragic figure there. I mean, this is really bizarre.
Well, it really is. But, you know, what really is going on there is it's evidence that some of these people that are in Congress, either in the House or the Senate, you know, they feel they own their seat.
Mm-hmm.
And because they've, you know, basically been reelected time and time again and by comfortable margins, and they've always been able to outspend their challengers. And after a while, they get so comfortable, they think that it's theirs, and they seem to lose sight of the fact that these seats in Congress are supposed to be, you know, of a rotational nature. But yet some of the people right here in Connecticut too, we have, you know, members of Congress who perceive the district as belonging to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really a problem that we have. The power of incumbency is so extreme in American politics, and it's so difficult to dislodge these people. And the hubris that comes with that is very disturbing, and Feinstein is just one example of that, but there are many.
Gary Rose with us for a couple of more minutes. Gary, now that Joe Lieberman seems to be public enemy number one for both parties here with no label, all of a sudden, here comes Joe Lieberman again like some ogre. Oh, look at this guy. What do you make of this no labels thing that, you know, Joe is the he is the face of this? He says, hey, we have $80 million to get on ballots here. They're on the ballot in five states. You think the other parties are really concerned or not?
You know, it is true. You know, polls show a lot of people are very high on, you know, a third party, or they don't want the Republicans or Democrats. But you know, Paul, you can get on the ballot, sure. But there are so many of these people in the middle who on election day will come home. You know, they will, and because so many unaffiliated voters, when they do vote, they do lean right or left. They lean Republican or Democrat. The polls clearly show that. So this no labels movement, it's an interesting one. But in some respects, we've kind of been there before, you know, with Ross Perot and so forth. But and in the end, it's still a two-party system, and that's where the vast, vast majority of voters basically, you know, call their home. Whether they're unaffiliated or not, they do lean, you know, and others who are members of the party obviously are very strongly committed to that. So, quite frankly, I don't like to predict stuff, but I tell you, I don't see a real future for the No Labels movement. I really don't.
And Gary, you mentioned, as some people do on this show when they call, you know, they mentioned Ross Perot. I mean, that guy, yeah, he was a little quirky, smart guy, though, in business. We know that, basically off of government contracts. But at the time, he did sound like such a refreshing, different voice. I mean, who could go on national TV, Gary, and talk about that sucking sound? Remember that the big sucking sound? Remember that? And we were enraptured with this guy for about 10 minutes. Remember that? Oh, my God.
Yeah. And at one time, he was polling very well, too. And that was before he pulled out of the race. But then it became increasingly clear that Ross Perot was kind of strange, and some of the things that he was claiming, why he withdrew from the race, that the Republicans were undermining his daughter's wedding. Wasn't there supposedly a Mexican hit squad
connected to Bush and the CIA, and he was just pulling it. Man. Yeah. Yikes.
But you're right, though. But he did address the deficit issue, and that's what really captivated people. But then Bill Clinton stole that issue and, absorbed a lot of his voters, as the two parties normally do with a rising third party. And so, but he was an interesting figure, and he did shake things up. But we did learn as we went along that Ross Perot might have a few issues of his own. Yeah.
Hey, Gary, final question before we let you go. I know you said you don't like to predict, and so maybe you'll change on this. You really think Joe Biden's going to be the nominee? I mean, we're still a year and a half out. Do you really think that Mr. Biden is going to be able to stick around, or, you know, is now they're saying, you know, Andrew Cuomo was lurking in the wings, Gavin Newsom. I mean, man, I don't know, Gary. Maybe he will be, but I just don't know.
And then there's RFK as well.
Yes.
Yeah, right. And then the Wall Street Journal today, Doug Schoen was suggesting that Michelle Obama actually could be a good nominee. Is he going to stick around? Yeah. I mean, Joe Biden, I think getting back to the Feinstein issue, you know, Joe Biden, again, this is all he's ever known is government. You know, he went into it as a very young man, and this is his life. So I have every reason to believe, again, you can't predict for certainty that he wants to be the nominee. And he could very well win this because it's so difficult to dislodge, you know, an incumbent president who's running for the nomination again. It's so unlikely for that to happen. And so I would not at all be surprised if Joe Biden is the nominee. He may not. Some things can happen between now and then. You know, it's still a ways before Iowa and New Hampshire, but South Carolina and the party in that party's case. But, you know, I think there's a very strong chance he will be the Democratic candidate for president again.
Gary, where's Harold Stassen when you need him? That's all I'm...
Yeah, there you go. Perennial candidate.
That's right.
Right. Why not?
Dr. Gary Rose. Gary, as always, good talking to you. We'll chat down the road. Thank you, sir.
Okay, Paul.
All right, there you go. The great Dr. Gary Rose, political science professor, Sacred Heart University in Fairfield.
This Title 42 issue, look, this has the fingerprints of all of Congress on it. This has the fingerprints of two presidential administrations. So what could be done right now that would give you confidence that the administration can handle this?
So Title 42 is required to be lifted by law, right? Title 42 allows you during a pandemic to stop individuals from presenting at the border and applying for asylum. And now that the pandemic is over, the president doesn't have discretion to keep Title 42 in place. So for all these Republicans who are complaining that the president acts outside of his authority, in this case, they seemingly want him to violate the law and turn people around at the border. The president has not been sitting on his hands like Republicans would allege. The president has been actively engaged in trying to manage this crisis. He has negotiated important agreements with Mexico so that Mexico takes more of these migrants. He has surged thousands of troops and asylum officials and Border Patrol to the border to handle this emergency. And he's put in place a really tough new rule that some, frankly, say goes beyond his authority to say to migrants, if you don't apply for asylum before you get to the United States, we're going to turn you right back around. Now, that doesn't mean that you aren't still going to have a lot of people showing up at the border, because that's just the consequence of having 2 years in which males, single adults, couldn't apply for asylum. But it's just simply not true that the president hasn't done enough to try to be as ready as possible.
I understand what you're saying about the preparation for this moment. But politically, other than introducing a bill on day one, he never talked about it. He didn't lean his shoulder in. Build Back Better was the focus. Everything else was the focus. And look, the Republicans have dirtier hands on immigration. I mean, but the Democrats don't have clean hands on this either.
Well, Republicans have had multiple opportunities to come to the table and pass immigration reform that would fix the problem at the border. And my belief is that while you have a small group of Republicans who legitimately want to engage, the majority of that party delights at chaos at the border. You saw some of my colleagues on Tuesday, as soon as votes were done, rush down to the border to take smiling photographs with the Border Patrol, essentially celebrating the fact that there was chaos, because they believe that there's political gain to be had. Yeah. So I think Americans know that it's Republicans, not Democrats, that have been sitting on the outside when it comes to fixing our broken immigration system.
Are you supportive of reinstituting Title 42? There's a bill in the Senate that could do that. It's gotten a little more support from Democrats, particularly ones that are on the ballot in 2024, which actually you are too, though not in as purple of a state as others. Would you be reluctantly supportive of that if you thought it was a tool they needed?
I'm not, because that just pushes the problem down the line, right? That just gives you one or two more years of individuals being denied entry. Whenever Title 42 is lifted, you are going to have this temporary problem of massive numbers of new people arriving at the border. And by the way, Republicans have been castigating the president for not lifting COVID restrictions fast enough. The only COVID restriction Republicans seem to want to keep in place is the one that keeps people that don't look like them from coming into the United States.
Why do you think the economic argument hasn't worked to get Republicans to the table? Because you can, our inflation problem, it's you can make one case on the free money issue with the Fed. You can make some case there. But the real issue is we have a labor shortage, and it's having an issue on wages. Our economic problem, yet it has no impact.
So despite my tough words for how Republicans approach this issue, I think there is still an opportunity, at least in the Senate, for bipartisan immigration reform. Maybe not the size of the bill in 2013, but I do think there are a group of Republicans in the Senate who recognize that we have this massive labor shortage everywhere in the country. You see help wanted signs, and that there is an ability to help the American economy by letting more people into the country legally. So I wouldn't be surprised if you see some discussions begin in the Senate in the wake of the House action last week to try to find some common ground in immigration reform.
You think that and a piecemeal direction. It's always going to be piecemeal at this point. The word comprehensive, just throw it away.
I think right now you've got to do the pieces that are most urgent. And to me, that's border security, that's asylum reform, and then that's doing something about the Dreamers who are here and need some help.
Debt ceiling, it looks like the White House is now negotiating. Something you didn't want to see. Spending caps are on the table. They're debating between 2 years, 10 years. Are you comfortable with a deal like that? Or do you think if you're going to cut a deal on spending, that maybe tax hikes ought to be a part of this?
Well, if we want to get serious about deficit reduction, then you have to put tax increases for billionaires and corporations on the table. That's why I'm pretty skeptical that there's going to be an agreement in the next 2 weeks. And what worries
me... Even a punted agreement for 3 months?
Well, what worries me is that Chuck Schumer, Joe Biden, even Mitch McConnell have said that if we can't get an agreement in the next few weeks, default is off the table. The only leader who says we are going to light the American economy on fire if we can't get an agreement in the next 10 to 14 days is Kevin McCarthy. And that is deeply worrying to me, because there's an opportunity to talk about their really unpopular agenda of cuts, but the time to do that is when we're negotiating the budget.
Would you start invoking the 14th Amendment and start paying the bills now if you were Joe Biden, in order to essentially launch the legal discussion about the 14th Amendment?
I don't want to give Joe Biden advice, but I think we should do our job. I think that's a precedent to just absolve Congress from being adults.
I want to talk about the issue of guns. And look, this has been something that you've been working on for quite some time, trying to find small increases in gun regulations or big ones. We saw another court ruling that essentially invoked and said, hey, there's just not much you could do because of the Second Amendment, this absolutist version and interpretation of the Second Amendment. Given that we have a court system, that this is what it's going to be, how do you tackle gun regulation under this environment? Do you go for a new a constitutional amendment, or do you just hope judges' philosophies change over the next generation?
Right now, the Supreme Court has made it clear, under the Heller decision, which still controls, they say there's a right to private gun ownership, but there is also an ability for Congress to regulate who owns weapons and what kind of weapons are owned. I think we have to continue to operate under that construct, and I really see progress, right? We broke a 30-year logjam last year by passing the first major gun safety initiative. Mm-hmm. You're seeing Republican states like Tennessee looking at red flag laws, Texas considering raising the age to buy assault weapons. I think our movement is in a position to win. Does it worry me what some of these district courts are doing? Absolutely. But right now, I think our focus has got to be growing the movement and continuing to capitalize on the progress of last year.
But it does sound like you got to do it within the construct of, look, you're probably not going to be able to regulate much having to do with access to the gun by anybody over 18.
Well, listen, if the Supreme Court eventually says mm-hmm. that states or the Congress can't pass universal background checks or mm-hmm. can't take these assault weapons off the streets, I think there's going to be a popular revolt over that policy. A court that's already pretty illegitimate is going to be in full crisis mode.
I want to put up something from our last poll. A majority thought that President Biden shouldn't seek a second term, and even Democrats, and they all pointed to the same thing. His age and his abilities to do the job. What gives you confidence that he's the best candidate the Democrats can put up in 2024?
So when we broke that 30-year logjam, 30 years of inaction on guns, there was a month in which we were negotiating that piece of legislation. Joe Biden was intimately involved in that process. I talked to Joe Biden probably every 3 or 4 days. He made a bold decision to go to the country and speak directly to them when many of his advisors told him not to. That bill would not have passed with Joe Biden's personal involvement. And so I have seen how effective this president is. And this narrative that Republicans are spinning is just their best argument against him, because they can't argue on the merits. They can't argue on the policies that he's passed, because he's had one of the most successful policy agendas of any president in their first two, 3 years.
Do you think that will translate into defeating Donald Trump?
And what Joe Biden reminds us is that elections are not a referendum. They are a choice. And as you pointed out, Donald Trump is advertising every single day what an irresponsible choice he is.
Our next guest is our Monday night spotlight guest here just after the 5 o'clock hour. He writes for the Connecticut News Junkie, now is writing for Substack. Check him out on the online at Substack. And he apparently had a pretty interesting, kind of a pretty unique experience, maybe not, a couple of days ago. Terry Cowgill's with us this afternoon on a Monday. Terry, good afternoon, sir, and how are you?
Oh, good afternoon. Yes, I now have a new friend.
Yes, and Terry, I'll tee you up here. Tell us about your encounter, Mr. Cowgill, with a black bear the other day. What happened?
Yeah, well, I was upstairs in my upstairs office, really my son's old bedroom, and I heard some noises, and I didn't think that much of it because there's a lot of home improvement construction going on in our neighborhood. But then it got louder. I thought, well, something's going on. I got down there, and I noticed that the garbage can in the kitchen was missing.
Oh boy.
And immediately I thought, okay, oops. Well, a bear has come in and taken away the garbage can, because nobody else is going to do that. So I looked out there, and, you know, the first thing I thought is the screen, of course, now on top of everything else, I'm going to have to replace my screen, because I'm sure she just ripped right through it. No, she just opened it patiently like I would whenever I go out there. Just opened the screen door, came in. So they were there, and, you know, I should have, in retrospect, I should have just closed the door and waited in for the leave. To leave, but my instinct to protect my property took over, and I got this adrenaline surge. So I said, "Well, I'm not going to let this animal get away with this." You know, so I went out into the deck. I got a bottle of a big jug of bleach. And I thought, well, if she charges at me, then I'll just douse her with bleach, and they don't even like the smell. So finally, the mother. Immediately when I started making noise, the cub scampered up the tree because it was a mother and a cub. And the mother sort of backed away slowly and got off the deck.
Mm-hmm.
So there I was, a 66-year-old man cleaning up garbage. And the bear and her mother sat there and watched me clean up their mess.
Oh, my God. How big was it? Terry, how big was this bear? I know it's hard to estimate, but a few hundred pounds. Yeah. How big was mom?
Yeah, you know, this was not a particularly large sow. You know, I would guess that I'm probably close to 200 pounds, and I would guess that this bear is probably less than that. And the cub was not a newborn. I'm thinking it was probably like a yearling because it was about the size of a full grown a golden retriever or something like that. So, yeah, I mean, she could have, if she really wanted to, she could have probably harmed me. Although I did have the bleach and, you know, they really don't like that stuff. So, that's what I did. And I got rid of it. So then that night I reported it to the DEP or the DEEP
mm-hmm.
now. And they came the next day and, well, they offered over the phone to come and put it in a trap and in an attempt to actually catch the bear. I did not notice any tags on the bear's ears, which means it's not hasn't been branded as a nuisance yet.
Yeah,
and I did not see a radio collar either. So they set up this trap. It's like a barrel shaped trap that they it's on a trailer and they kind of back it into the backyard there.
Yeah, I saw the picture you put up there. I saw the picture. Yeah, yeah.
Yes, right. And of course, funny enough, the bait is a bag of donuts.
Come on. Are you serious?
Yeah, that's what it is.
Jeez. And do we know what attracted an off-duty cop? Oh, boy. Jeez.
Somebody said on Facebook, I never, of course, made that joke. But.
Of course not. You picked it up.
Yeah.
Terry Cowgill is the guest. Now, did they say, is there, like, I don't know, do bears like glazed, cream-filled, crullers? Do we have any idea, Terry, what the brand is there or not?
Well, if they're like me, they like the jelly crullers, but I'm not exactly sure what kind they put in there. But they did say that these traps, they do not have a high rate of success.
Okay.
And it's been here since Thursday afternoon. And there's been no bear yet, but it's still sitting there. And the animals are listening to this broadcast and are interested in a meal, you might try it out.
They're probably watching from a distance and they're elbowing each other, going, "Look at this! They think we're that dumb. We're gonna crawl into there." Terry, on a serious note, though, you know this is, and we've talked seriously about this, and. You know, you have talked to somebody who obviously now lives in the middle of this. You know, thank God you weren't harmed or anybody in your family and you acted quickly and they backed away with the bleach. But, you know, Terry, I just perish the thought that that wouldn't be in some other location where there might have been a small child in a different part of the house. I mean, just all these things, Terry, and I know you've taken a very rational opinion on this, that we have to look at everything to be able to at least slow this down. My God.
Yeah, you know, and I was watching, it was a replay from, I guess, last weekend of, it was one of the Sunday Connecticut talk shows. I can't remember if it was Dennis House or or maybe NBC Connecticut. But they interviewed the commissioner of the DEEP.
Yeah.
And she noted that, you know, they're all for a limited hunting season, you know, and their life is, their profession really is geared toward protecting the environment and, and respect for nature. But they're really to the point where they think something needs to be done because all of the surrounding states, New York and Massachusetts, at least, they do have limited bear hunting seasons. And I don't know about Rhode Island, but certainly New York and Massachusetts do. And but for some reason, there's an aversion to it here in Connecticut. And I'd like to see that change. And I know that Deepwood also.
Yeah. And Terry, I think you and I discussed this before. You know, this is still a big little state. And I think that there are legislative members who you and I have talked to, both you, you know, and living near them and me here on the show, who are a little squeamish about this, because if they vote, you know, Terry, for this hunt,
in some of these races. These races are decided by 50, 100 votes, 150, 200 votes. You know, they could be putting their legislative seat on the line. And I hate to say it, but I think a lot of people, Terry, on both sides of the aisle don't have the spine, the backbone to, as they love to say, follow the science.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I think that's even more true on the national level, where you have all of these gerrymandered districts, and the biggest threat to your reelection is really being primary.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose that's true to a certain extent on the local level, too. It just depends on where you are. And certainly I live in a purple district, which has had a purple House district, state House district, which has had Democrats and Republicans represent it over the last 20 years at least. But yeah, that can be a problem. I mean, nobody wants to have a blemish on their record that could, throw them out of office. Although in Connecticut, it's not as cushy a job as it is in Washington. So,
Absolutely. Yeah. Any now that you have, was this the closest you've ever gotten to one, Terry? I mean, obviously, if it's in your house, but, you know, once it's scooted, was that the closest you've ever been to a bear?
I believe so. There was once or twice there was a bear in the garage back when I used to keep garbage in the garage. And I opened the door to the garage when I heard noise, and that bear quickly scampered away.
Oh, my God.
It wasn't really much of an encounter. But, yeah, this is definitely the closest I've ever been to them. And they're really kind of, you know, they look cuddly from a distance.
Oh, but, no.
Boy, these guys look pretty mangy.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other one, the mother actually went a little far away from the deck and decided to use the bathroom. It is my, you know, functions as my yard. So I got the full bear experience.
Very nice. Now, Terry, you know that now I understand they're really expensive, but I guess they make these bear-proof trash cans. Have you read about these things? Have you heard about them?
Yes. Yeah. My neighbors have some. I have, and they are expensive. And if you want a bear-proof garbage can, a lot of the curbside pickup people will charge you extra because the bear-proof garbage cans really are expensive. But the thing is, you know, you don't bring it out until the day of the pickup. But even then, you know, that leaves a window. If you bring them out in the morning and the guy doesn't come until the afternoon, that means it's going to sit there.
They're waiting.
Sure enough.
They're waiting.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah. You know, they probably got security cameras, bears do. they can just watch everybody's house. I don't know. But it's they certainly have a sixth sense about where garbage is. And as I pointed out in my column, you know, that bear could have had real food in my house if they had just paused to look around. There was fresh fruit on the counter. There was crackers and cereals and chips inside the pantry. They could have had a real meal, but instead they went straight for the garbage.
Well, the other stuff you have, Terry, hadn't forgive my phraseology here, it had not fermented yet. They must love the fermentation of the stuff in the garbage.
I think that's true because it does have a stronger smell than a bag of chips.
Yeah,
you know, it reeks, and they're drawn to it. I think they're also drawn to the plastic of the containers.
Really?
They see them and they immediately associate the big plastic thing with the garbage. So
yeah. They talked to that dog that Dr. Pavlov had. I think they might have spoken to the Pavlov pooch. Terry Cowgill, thank you. Terry, thank God you're okay on a serious note. And again, don't stop writing about this because we have to come to a balance here, loving nature and public safety. Terry, thanks. We'll talk next week.
Okay, Paul. Take care.
Appreciate it. Terry Cowgill there. Check him out at ctnewsjunkie.com. And he writes a column on Substack, Substack, Substack.com. It's kind of a forum for writers who may not want to be encumbered by a newspaper or a certain publication, even though Terry does write for the Connecticut News Junkie. Wow. How about that? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC, hearing a noise, going downstairs, and seeing a bear take the kitchen garbage can out. Yikes.